Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with my producer, Jason DeFilippo. Today, we're talking with my friend, Scott Harrison. He is an amazing guy. He went from barely graduating high school, became one of the top promoters in New York City, making at least $200K a year in his early 20s. That's not what's amazing, though. He went into debt while starting a charity and now runs one of the most well-known charities, helping millions of people in the world get clean water. This is a heck of a story. He's a heck of an can you say entrepreneur for charity? I think you can. Today, we'll discover how you can get your foot in the door of an industry and claw your way to the top through hustle and creativity. We'll explore how we can expand our thinking, our horizons, and try to divine a sense of purpose if you're feeling lost or maybe you're ready for a change. And we'll uncover how creativity and storytelling is the key to creating an emotional connection with your line of work, your product or business, whether you're selling overpriced champagne to investment bankers in Manhattan or giving life-saving clean water to kids in Africa. Really a great story and a great storyteller. And if you want to know how I managed to book all these great people and manage my relationships using systems and tiny habits, please check out our Level 1 course. It is free. It's over at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. And of course, we've got worksheets for today's episode. If you like what Scott has to say and you want to make sure you hammer down those practicals, go ahead and go to the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast, and you can find the worksheets alongside the show notes right there. Now, here's Scott Harrison. So first of all, I assume you've done a lot of these interviews and you've been flying around a lot. How did you become Lord Scott Harrison? Let's start with the most awkward detail in the book.
Well, during my club times, one of my best friends that was working at a club with me was British. And first of all, he taught me about 20 bad words, 20 swear words that I had just never heard before. But he then had this idea that to get free upgrades, one just needed to retitle themselves, right? Which is as simple as calling up American or Delta or United and giving yourself a title. So Lord could work, Duke could work, Duchess could work. So I thought Lord was the most appropriate title. So I called up all the airlines and said, please change my frequent flyer information to Lord Scott Harrison, hoping that this would, you know, deliver me a mimosa in seat 56E. It rarely worked.
Yeah, I would imagine they're like, oh, let's put this British royalty guy next to the bathroom so he sees how the rest of us live for once.
Exactly. It was so pretentious and nauseating.
Yeah, but hey, look, fun times. I remember running a credit card for a guy who, and at one of our events at Advanced Human Dynamics, and he had changed his name to like Lord or Baron or something. And I thought, wow, how often does that do anything? And he's like, pretty much never. And he said it with like this.
At least he was honest.
Yeah. And he said it with this almost like Southern accent. And I thought, well, there's a reason for that. You know, if you're going to, you got to lean into it, man. You can't just do the title with no British accent. I think that might have been the key. And you mentioned your club days, and we'll get to that in a second, because you were kind of one of the premier or the premier club promoter in New York City, which is obviously not what this interview is about, but you did have some overlap with what you learned there with Charity Water. But I want to start earlier on with your childhood, because it's sort of a strange path that you've taken, and I don't think we can get a complete picture without a little bit of your childhood in there. Tell us how you grew up and how that influenced what you're doing now.
I think it starts at 4. I was born into a middle-class family in Philadelphia. Dad was a business guy. Mom was a writer. And then when I was 4 years old, we moved into a new home. It was this gray, drab house. It wasn't very attractive on the outside, little four-bedroom house on a cul-de-sac. There was a good kindergarten, you know, down at the end of the block. But unknown to our family at the time, there was a huge problem with this house. And the house had a carbon monoxide gas leak. Now, this is almost 40 years ago. The detector that we all go to Home Depot now and buy in blister packs, it hadn't even been invented. And we had no idea. So we move into this house. We all start getting sick, my mom, my dad, myself. And on New Year's Day, 1980, my mom walks across the bedroom and she collapses unconscious on the floor. And, you know, we take her to the hospital eventually and to doctors. And after a long series of blood tests, they find these massive amounts of carbon monoxide in her bloodstream. And my dad actually had suspected the gas company. He had invited him out a couple times before just to check everything. And the gas company said, no, everything's fine. So my dad, with a plumber friend, actually rips out the furnace and they find the leak. And my dad and I had only been sleeping in the house at night. So we got a little sick, but we bounced back. And mom never bounced back. She didn't die from the exposure, but her immune system was irreparably destroyed from this point on. So she became unable to process or fight off any of the chemicals or everyday toxins that we're exposed to. So things like perfume would make her deathly ill. Car fumes, fabric softener, soap, even the ink from books, like that smell of new print, would make her really sick. So at 4 years old, as a child, I watched my mom go from this healthy, vibrant, super mom, super wife, journalist, to a complete invalid, wearing charcoal masks connected to oxygen tanks, and then eventually living in a safe room, a room that was covered in aluminum foil and washed with special soap, and sleeping on an army cot that had been washed in baking soda more than 10 times. So childhood, Jordan, was just weird. I instantly was thrust into a caregiver role. So dad and I were helping to take care of mom. I was doing the cooking. I was doing the cleaning. I was just helping out around the house, doing the stuff that a mom would do. And I was a little surprised later, you know, learning this, but my parents, because of their deep and really authentic Christian faith, had decided not to sue the gas company. You know, we believe they could have gotten millions and millions of dollars, but they just didn't want to become bitter. You know, this was, after all, an accident, and I think they took a $1,250 settlement check and just hoped for the best. So my childhood was really a virtuous childhood. I wanted to be a doctor when I grew up. I wanted to help mom get well and other sick people like her. I didn't smoke. I didn't drink. I played piano in church on Sundays. I was kind of a good kid.
So you ended up taking care of your mom, of course. And it's strange that, well, actually, it's not strange that she was the only one who got sick, right? Because she was probably working from home. You were at school all day and your dad was at the office.
And it was winter. So the house, it was an energy efficient home that was completely closed up in the dead of winter. So she was getting 24 hours of exposure and we were getting 9 or 10 only at night.
All right. And it sounds like you were a little bit of an angry child. I read the book Thirst. My wife did as well. We both loved it. And you kind of, I mean, you acted out a little bit, right? I mean, that's typical, I guess, but it sounds like you had a little bit of extra.
A little extra angst?
Yeah, a little bit extra angst.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it was I wanted my family to be normal. I wanted my mom to be like the other moms, and I felt like I missed out on things as a kid. And, you know, this rebellion really started around kind of the late teens. And there was a dramatic shift in my life at the age of 18. You know, you have to just understand through this period of time, I was that kid who barely went to high school. You know, I skipped the maximum amount of classes that I could. My parents actually didn't know that I was going to graduate until the very last day. And I was playing in a rock band. I was cutting school. I was playing pool. I started to kind of act out towards the end of high school. And then at 18, with the freedom to actually leave home, I was just done. I wanted to explore the dark side. I wanted to explore everything the church said you can't do. You know, if my parents were preaching light and virtue, I wanted to sow my oats. You know, I wanted to explore sex, drugs, and rock and roll and see how that felt. And someone took me to a club for the first time in New York City. And it was a huge club. I remember there was a line outside, you know, people packed around the velvet rope, and the guy I was with knew people, and the crowd parted and the doorman ushered us in. And I remember going up to the top of this club. It was two levels, and there was a slide that you would wait for, and then you would hurl yourself down into this mass of humanity with laser lights and loud music and scantily clad girls and guys. And I just remember thinking, I'm home. I mean, this is the opposite of my life. This is the thing to explore. And that led to this pursuit of nightlife. And, you know, I couldn't believe that there was a city, New York, and there was this job called a nightclub promoter where people would pay you lots of money to drink for free. Right. People would actually pay us to drink in public, and all of our friends would drink for free. And the job, just all you had to do was get the right beautiful people inside the right venues. And if you did that, you could charge them extraordinary markup on alcohol. People would pay $20 for a vodka soda. People would pay, you know, $800 for a bottle of champagne that cost you $50. And over the next 10 years, I just climbed up the social ladder of New York, working at 40 different clubs. And 10 years later, I found myself with most of the things that I thought I wanted, most of the things that I had been pursuing that I thought would make me happy. And I wasn't.
Yeah, spoiler alert, right? But so this must have made a really strong impression on you, walking in, not waiting in line, because, and among the other perks, because most people who go to clubs a few times are like, yeah, I don't want to stand outside for 2 hours. It's cold. This is terrible. People are smoking. I don't want to be around this. It's too expensive. You kind of had that
VIP
hookup
experience. Yeah. When you're in the VIP, it's all different. And I wanted to be the VIP club promoter.
Right. Yeah. You wanted to be like high end, and you got there, because 10 years is a long time to go club. That's a long time. Do you ever look at that and go, okay, could have done that in three? Right. Like, it's a long time.
Wish I had done that in three. And you age more than 10 years in the club. So, you know, imagine throughout this whole time, I've smoked 2 to 3 packs of Marlboro Reds every single day. I pick up an insane drinking problem. I pick up a cocaine problem, ecstasy, MDMA, Special K, marijuana. I've got a pornography addiction. I've got a strip club problem. I've got a gambling problem. I remember once gambling on European soccer games that weren't even televised. I really descended into darkness and depravity. But my life from the outside, if you just saw me going to dinner at the hottest restaurant at 10 p.m. with, you know, surrounded by beautiful women and business owners or people in fashion, if you saw us in the VIP at the club spraying champagne from the DJ booth, you'd think, wow, this guy's living the life, right? I mean, he's in the VIP. And so there were really these two things that the condition of my soul, the condition of my heart was rotting inside. And I think that was even more pronounced because it was in such contrast to the spirituality and the morality that I'd been brought up under. My parents had given me a foundation. They had taught me kindness and grace and, you know, and love and virtue. And here I am polluting not only myself, Jordan, but actually polluting others for a living. I mean, I make more money the more wasted people leave our club when the lights come on at 4.
You had me at 3 packs of Marlboro Reds every day. That's just...
Jordan, I kid you not. I liked smoking so much. I would wake up in the middle of the night and, you know, on my way to pee, I'd be so happy that I was awake so I could smoke 1 or 2 cigarettes in the bathroom. I was a fiend.
That is just... Your body at that point is just not making anything of its own. It's all taking it in externally, right? All the feel goods chemicals.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you certainly don't get high anymore.
Yeah.
You don't feel anything when you smoke 60 cigarettes a day.
Oh my gosh. Unbelievable. Well, you must have had a tough time shaking yourself out of that, but I kind of want to back up a little bit. A lot of people, not that they want to get into club promoting, but you got your foot in the door of this by asking somebody, what, how can I get into this business? Because I think a lot of people want to get into some business that feels closed to them. Nightclub promoting is a good example of this, even if it's not something that most people aspire to. How did you get started and get on the right path in that industry, even if it did lead you astray?
Yeah, well, it started with a band that I was in, and the band was getting booked at a couple nightclubs. And at the end of the night, you know, the promoter would throw us like $100 and say, hey, divvy this up 6 ways, right?
Oh,
I mean, we wouldn't even pay for gas for our cars to bring our gear out. And, you know, the promoter would go home with all the money. So when the band broke up, and we broke up, A, because we hated each other, and B, because we were doing drugs, at that moment, I just said, well, why don't I jump to the other side? You know, rather than be a struggling artist, why don't I actually go and find the struggling artists and make money off the back of them? And it felt like, you know, do you want to be the owner or do you want to be the bartender? And I felt like with the band, I was the bartender and I had this opportunity to be an owner.
And you asked some guy at that point, look, can I work for free and learn the ropes?
Yeah. So the hottest club was opening up in New York City at that moment. It was called Lotus. The owners were, there were four owners. They were on the cover of New York Magazine. And I really wanted to work there badly. So I just start calling and leaving voicemail messages on the main club number. And then I start dialing through to the owner's private voicemail messages. And I said, I want to work. I'll do anything. Finally, I think I just wore them down. And one of them, Jeffrey, calls me back and says, hey, kid, I'll give you a shot on our deadest night. You can promote for $150 all night. I'll give you a Monday. And I had my foot in the door. And, you know, gosh, less than a year later, I was doing the hottest night and making a lot more.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Scott Harrison. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored in part by MeUndies. You've heard me talk about MeUndies about a million times, which is, you know, that's why I have a million pairs of underwear. But why am I so actually obsessed with them? Well, when I wake up in the morning, all groggy, which is pretty usual, I get excited to go to my underwear drawer and pick out which undies I'm going to wear for the day. I know that sounds ridiculous. I don't really care. They've got really fun prints. It's like my own little secret, knowing I'm wearing a crazy print at all hours. And they use micromodal fabric. It's a full 3 times softer than regular cotton. It's hard to explain how soft something is because you might say, like, it's softer than cotton, which is kind of not really that descriptive. But it's the exact fabric you're going to want down there. Let me put it that way. And they've got fun new prints each month. They've got matching socks. If you're wearing bralettes, they've got bralettes. I'm not even sure what bralettes are, but, you know, they got those and they match your underwear. Let me put it that way. And you can get a matching pair with your partner. That's the point. They've also got 100% satisfaction guarantee, so you're going to love the undies. But if you're not into it, you can send back your used undies, slightly used, for a full refund. Jason, where can they find that?
To get your 15% off your first pair, free shipping, and 100% satisfaction guarantee, go to MeUndies.com/Jordan. That's MeUndies.com/Jordan.
This episode is sponsored in part by HostGator. Have you seen what they've been saying about you online? Yes or no, good or bad, there's no denying that you and nobody else should have control over that narrative. Whether it's for your business or your personal brand, as the kids say these days, building the website people see first when they search for you on the internet has never been easier thanks to HostGator. Best of all, you don't have to know the first thing about coding to get your own professional-looking and feature-packed website up and running today. HostGator takes care of the boring and intimidating details of website management, yet the stuff you don't want to deal with. You can focus on doing what you love to do, and that's why we recommend HostGator's website builder. HostGator allows you to choose from over 100 mobile-friendly templates, so your site's going to look good on the phone, on a tablet, on a desktop, laptop, whatever. And if you want to use WordPress for your site, it only takes one click. Add-on options are aplenty. You can integrate with PayPal. People can send you money. Can't beat that. You can increase your search engine visibility without being some sort of SEO expert. And you'll also get a guaranteed 99.9% uptime. And HostGator's support team is there to help with any issues you experience 24/7, 365. And don't worry about all that breaking the bank either. HostGator is giving our wonderful listeners up to 62% off all packages for new users with a 45-day complete money-back guarantee. Oh, and you even get unlimited email addresses based from your website that you can hand out in place of that free Gmail address you've been using for ages. So go to HostGator.com/Jordan right now to sign up. That's HostGator.com/Jordan.
Thanks for listening and supporting the show. To learn more about our sponsors and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/advertisers. And if you'd be so kind, please drop us a nice rating and review in iTunes or your podcast player of choice. It really helps us out and helps build the show family. If you want some tips on how to do that, head on over to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Now back to our show with Scott Harrison.
You built an email list 15, 20 years ago almost, or something like that, right? So you were early to adding tech into this kind of industry.
We were, and it was expensive to mail flyers or to distribute flyers. And we were early on with email. And I remember when we started building that list, I mean, email open rates were like 100%, right? Everybody opened every email that came in. And that, we started to build that, like you said, to about 15,000. And we would be throwing fashion parties. We would be throwing store openings, parties for magazines. We always try to keep it interesting. We would throw pool parties where we would rent lifeguard stations and hire people to sit there and go get 100 beach balls. We would throw parties where we asked everybody to come in their pajamas. We're always just trying to find the interesting and the new, because it gets pretty boring. I mean, imagine going to the same club night in, night out, hearing the DJ play the same songs. It's pretty much the same people. And you're shouting over the din. And you know, what kind of conversations can you have? You can have abrupt 1 to 2 sentence conversations with no substance, no meaning. And you're just kind of sitting there looking cool, drinking into oblivion, or doing worse.
Yeah, I can imagine that this started to catch up with you. 3 packs of Marlboro Reds, cocaine, women, alcohol. You started doing Ambien to fall asleep.
Yep.
And you're 28, and then suddenly you can't feel one of your arms, or what was going on then? Because 28 is a little young to be falling apart, right?
Yeah, I'll say. I just, half my body just goes numb. And I start seeing neurologists, and yeah, they're doing brain scans and MRIs. And I just don't know what's wrong with me, and everything's checking out fine. And now my partner's like, well, dude, maybe lay off the drugs and the smoking and the booze.
And you're like, LOL, bro, not a chance. Any other suggestions?
I could cut back a little bit, but hey, it's not that.
Right.
So this happened for a couple months, and then I go on a New Year's Eve vacation, as we did. So we hated New York City around New Year's Eve. All the tourists flooded the city. The clubs were awful. It was we would call it a bridge and tunnel crowd. I mean, all the locals just got out of town that could afford to. And, you know, we were catering to people who could afford to. So we would go to Brazil, or we'd go to Europe, or we'd go, this year we went to South, to Punta del Este, a town in Uruguay, kind of a party town. And I remember renting this compound around a pool, and there were servants waiting on us and cooking our food. There were horses walking around in the backyard, and there were magnums of Dom Perignon. So we had all the champagne that we could drink. We went to the fireworks store. We dropped $1,000 in cash to blow up some fireworks on our little lawn. And it was just, it was it. Like, this is what you do. Right? We've arrived. There was a mega yacht that we were renting. I think we'd flown in on some guy's private plane. I remember one of the guys at the local casino was throwing down $10,000 a hand at baccarat.
That's right? Insane.
$10,000. He actually looked indifferent, Jordan, to whether he won or lost, right? If you're playing $10,000, it just doesn't matter to you. And I just had the realization on this trip. It's almost like the game of musical chairs, where the music stopped, and for the first time in 10 years, I looked around and I had no place to sit. Something was different. It's like the veil was lifted as I looked around and I saw people who were richer than me. And I realized that this was an insatiable desire for more, that if I continued to pursue girls, money, fame, you know, drugs, there would never be enough. Someone would always have more. And this was a race to the bottom. It was kind of a race to, you know, to hell in some way. And I had done nothing with my faith or virtue, you know, any of the childhood foundation that my parents had tried to build for that decade. And there was something about doing so many drugs in Uruguay and waking up the next morning hungover that I start reading my Bible again. I start reading a book of deep theology that my father had given to me at Christmas. And in some ways, you know, when I'm reading about Jesus or when I'm reading some of this theology, I felt like I was reading the exact opposite picture of my life. I mean, this was about service to the poor. This was about loving your neighbor as yourself. This was about leading a life above reproach. And it wasn't, you know, I almost came to discover Jesus differently. He wasn't the religious kind of oppressor, the purveyor of rules, right? That I had remembered all the don't do this, don't do that. He actually was kind of giving the middle finger to the religious establishment of the day, to the Pharisees and the system that oppressed people. And he was going, living this life of purity, a life without things, a life of unselfishness. And there was something just so attractive to that. In some ways, it's like the it felt like the story of the prodigal son, where the prodigal asks his dad for his inheritance, and you know, he breaks his father's heart, leaves home, says, "I'm done with this place, right? This place sucks. I'm going to go explore the world." Takes the money, squanders it on drinking and prostitutes, and eventually comes to the end of that journey, of that money, and says, "Man, I want to come home. Home didn't suck. This sucks.
Yeah.
The gambling sucks. The prostitute sucks. 3 packs a day of Marlboro Reds. The coughing sucks. The hangovers suck. The trying to put yourself to sleep at noon, you know, popping an Ambien after a night of party. This sucks." So I wanted to come home. And what's so amazing about that parable, you know, the prodigal son parable, is that when the son finally made that long journey home, instead of being reproved, instead of being yelled at, instead of being shamed, there's this picture of the father that runs out to him and embraces him and says, "My son is home," and throws his arm around him and throws him a party, right? There is no word spoken of the past, of what he did. He's just so happy that his son has come home. So I wondered whether I could have that kind of radical turnaround, whether I could find my way back to a life of virtue and purity and spirituality.
But you got to make some radical changes to do that, because if every single day you're going out with people who are throwing down six-figure parties and you got models blowing up your phone all the time and everybody that you thought was your friend blowing up your phone all the time, you're the man. You can't just be like, "Nah, sorry, I'm going to take a few days off." There's too much temptation. You have to unplug. You have to unplug it and plug it back in.
And that was the problem. So for the 6 months after that I came back, my heart had changed, my intention had changed, but my job hadn't. And it's really hard. So what happened, Jordan? I tried to smoke less. I tried to sleep around less. I tried to drink less. I tried to do less drugs. And, you know, I would have what I call it a few weeks of sobriety. And then there would be that one night and I'm like, "Oh, well, I'm out late and I need to stay up. So what's one hit? What's one bump?" And then I would just feel, you know, kind of the guilt and shame of failure, because now this stuff wasn't fun. Like, I knew that I shouldn't be doing it. I wanted, it's almost like I got, you know, waylaid on my way home. I didn't go straight home. I stopped along the way.
Yeah.
So it took me until the fall of that year. And I write about, you know, the actual details of this event a little more in the book. But there was a moment in club life that gave me a couple weeks to just get out of the city, to gain perspective. And I was driving north. I was headed towards Maine eventually. And I just started thinking, like, what if I made a change? What would the opposite of my life look like? What could a 180 degree turn look like? Not a pivot, not a little redirect, not a do all this stuff a little less. Like, what would the radical life change look like? What would it look like to quit all of this crap? What would it look like to serve others instead of myself? And it, in the fall of that year, or actually in the late summer of that year, from a dial-up internet cafe in Maine, a little town called Greenville, I get the idea that I'm going to apply to the famous humanitarian organizations I've heard of over the past 10 years, and I'm going to do 1 year of humanitarian service. From my religious upbringing, there was this idea called the tithe, where you give one-tenth away. And that was my idea. I'm going to give one of the 10 years that I'd wasted and serve others, try and quit all the crap and see where that might lead me. So I put in all these applications. And from that moment, I never go back to New York City. I give up my apartment. I sell almost every possession that I have. And I wait. And I wait to see who's going to take me and what opportunity felt like the best.
Okay, so you decide, I've got to do some escapism, and what better way to do that than to try to make a hard right turn and do something positive? I would imagine that might be a little tricky, because they're like, what's your level of experience? What have you done in the past? And you're like, here's a bunch of pictures of me drunk and wasted with a bunch of strangers acting the fool. I've done that for the last decade. What else do you need to know about me, right? Like, you know, like, where do we sign up?
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. So you don't have to be that smart to realize that's how it went. So the organizations that I applied to just flat out deny me. What would they ever have to do with a nightclub promoter? I mean, how would I be in any way useful to their humanitarian mission? And finally, only one organization says yes. And the terms were fantastic. They said, hey, we're going to need you to go live in post-war Liberia. This is a country that had just escaped a civil war after 14 years. And we're going to need you to pay us $500 a month. So I'm like, this is perfect.
Yeah.
Right. Not only I'm going to go broke volunteering and I get to go to the poorest country in the world. I mean, I'd never even heard of this country. So the position I accepted was that of a volunteer photojournalist. And I'd actually been a pretty good writer as a kid. I used to write for the local newspaper and I was a pretty good photographer. And I said, look, the cool thing is I've got 15,000 people on my club list. So I'm going to be able to write stories and share photos with influential people back in New York of whatever amazing humanitarian work you guys happen to be doing. So I actually thought this was a role that I could be effective in. So they take me in the fall, so September of that year. So there's New Year's Eve in January. There's kind of 6-7 months of floundering. And then in September of that year, I set foot in Africa for the first time in my life. And I joined this medical mission, a group of 350 doctors and surgeons and volunteer crew that were operating out of a 42-bed hospital on a 500-foot hospital ship. You know, this is a football field and a half, a huge converted cruise liner that had been turned into a hospital. And my job is going to be to take pictures and document the work and tell stories of the people that we're going to help.
Everyone on the ship has to pay their own room and board, right? Even the surgeons are shelling out for this. This is not a revenue generating opportunity.
No, it's exactly the opposite, right? You go broke volunteering. But that it was a brilliant business model that they effectively used us as their fundraisers. So we would all either pay our own money or go raise support from friends and family to be able to serve.
Oh, that makes sense, right? Because if they're in charge of finding the money, then it's kind of, they got to fund donations and it's a huge expense. But if every single
person...
We were
a fundraising army, right? We were this fundraising army.
Yeah, it's like
all those 500s a month added up to something.
Yeah, like you can't go unless you can get the money. And then it's like, hey, grandma, can I have $5,000 or whatever? Right.
So you got it.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. So did you have any idea how hard that was actually going to be? Not raising the money. I'm sure that part was something that you'd been used to. But I mean, taking pictures of somebody with horrible diseases before and after, seeing people. What was the ship environment like? I assume you pull into port and it's just like pandemonium.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never seen the stuff that we were seeing. You know, I'll just give you an example. So my third day on the mission, the ship pulls into port and I learned that the government has given us a football stadium, so a big soccer stadium, and we're going to be triaging the patients there. So we would set up different stations inside and the doctors would try and schedule people that we were able to help for surgery. And I knew we had 1,500 surgery slots to fill. So I'm all excited. It's my third day on the mission. I wake up at 5 a.m. I put on hospital scrubs, right? Looking official. I grab my two Nikon cameras and I jump into a convoy of Land Rovers with the doctors and the nurses as we're heading toward the football stadium. And as we turn the corner, I see there are 5,000 people standing outside.
Oh my God.
And I remember it hit me. I mean, I was filled with so much sadness with the reality that, oh my gosh, like we're going to send home 3,000 people. They don't know it yet, but we just don't have enough doctors. We don't have enough surgery slots. I later learned that so many of these people had walked for more than a month. Some of them had walked with their children from neighboring countries just in the hope of seeing a doctor. You know, in some ways, we had a velvet rope out. Right. I mean, not unlike the clubs, except in this case, you know, we weren't turning away people for another club. We were turning away people often to a death wish.
Right.
Because there were too many of them.
Right. So it became kind of a death sentence. If you couldn't get in there, you'd spend all your money. You'd spend all your time traveling with a sick relative or yourself. And it was your last hope. And it was kind of like, sorry.
Well, the reason was there's just too many of you. I mean, we have a limited amount of slots and we're going to just fill every single surgery slot up. But they were just, the need was so great.
That's unbelievable, right? Because these people haven't had regular medical care maybe ever.
Yeah. And okay, so what we're seeing kids that are suffocating to death on massive facial tumors, like tumors filling their eyes, filling their mouth. Saw people coming with leprosy, people coming that had been burned by rebels during the war with arms fused together, with legs fused together as the rebels would pour oil on them, you know, as a form of torture. We would see people who were blind with cataracts or waterborne diseases like trachoma.
It's like a mass of people waiting outside. I'm just envisioning this mass of people waiting outside the port, just like you see in those apocalypse movies where zombies have taken over or the government falls and there's like a fence and there's just people waiting by the fence. I mean, how close am I on this?
Yeah, I mean, it was very orderly until it was a 2-day screening. At the end of the second day, we shut the doors. We packed up with every surgery slot full. And then we headed back to the ship, and that was tough. I mean, people were throwing their hands up. They were upset. Right? We couldn't help people. I mean, there was definitely an edge in the air that day.
Oh man, that's not a job you want, being the person who decides this is the last person and we have to close the doors now.
So no, and you know what? I think the way that I got through that day was I really tried to focus on the hope. I tried to focus on the people we were helping. I mean, we were able to help 1,500 people get scheduled for surgery, 1,500 people. And that, you know, we were able to remove tumors and save people's lives. And we were able to remove cataracts and allow people to see for the first time in their life. It was a really, it then kind of for me, I just started focusing on like, okay, let's tell stories of hope. There are 1,500 stories that we're going to be able to tell of transformation.
Yeah, that is incredible. How long does it take to do 1,500 surgeries? How many days is that?
It was 4 months.
Wow. And then the ship just runs out of supplies and it's got to go.
Then the ship moves on to its next place.
Oh, wow. How come you don't just stay in one place for like a year and just do as many surgeries as you can?
It takes about 4 months to do 1,500 surgeries. And we were, because Liberia was just opening up for the first time in 14 years, we did 4 months in a country called Benin, and then we sailed up to Liberia. Typically, the ship will do an 8-month outreach, so it'd be able to do about double that many surgeries.
Wow. And then it just runs out of supplies or something like that, and you got to go?
Moves on to the next country. The ship dry docks in South Africa. It was really old. The ship was 52 years old at that point. So it could do about 8 months of active service, and then it would be off for 4 months, which would also give the doctors a break and people would go home and see their families.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Scott Harrison. We'll be right back after this.
This episode is also sponsored by OneFix. Most diets fail. Surprise. Said, you know, nobody. Nobody should be surprised by that. They make you change way too many foods all at once. That's one reason why they don't work that well. And when you want to fix how you eat, you actually have to do the opposite. You have to make one change and do it slowly and let it stick. And that's what I like about OneFix. It's an app, and a nutritionist will analyze your meals. You literally take a picture of your food, which most of you are freaking doing anyway. You know who you are, but you send it to a nutritionist instead of sending it to the world on Instagram. And the nutritionist finds one thing that's causing your body to store extra fat or whatever your goal is, and they'll give you one fix. And you do that one fix every day for 1 month. And if you're just doing one fix, it's actually pretty easy. And when it becomes a part of who you are, then you can begin the next fix. So if diabetes or heart disease run in your family, an extra 30 pounds, that can literally kill you. Not even 30 pounds, can literally kill you. You should be worried about that. Diets are a terrible way to lose weight. When you want to make it permanent, do one fix at a time. Jason, tell them where they can get OneFix.
Go to getonefix.com and use the code Jordan to get $50 off your first month. That's getonefix.com and use the code Jordan to get $50 off the first month. Once you download the app, a nutritionist will help get you started. Get OneFix today.
I got to say, Jen and Glenn, my brother-in-law, have been using it, and they're digging it. It's cool. There's like a chat, and the nutritionist gets back to you right away, and it's like, yeah, this looks good. Are those potatoes, or is it sausage? It's like, okay, it's potatoes. Great, okay, try to cut down on this. Add a little more of that. Oh, if you're still hungry, add some this. It's pretty cool. It's great to have expert advice in your pocket like that.
And it's great that it's a human and not some AI offshore worker, you know?
No, I have strongly suspect there's an office full of people looking at a lot of food all day. Yeah.
Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers is what keeps us on the air. To learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/advertisers. Now for the conclusion of our show with Scott Harrison.
I read that you bought a lot of losing team gear. So like if a team loses the Super Bowl, that gear all goes to, I guess, buyers in Africa. I didn't know that was real. Yeah, I thought that was urban legend.
No, we didn't, but we would see that in the markets as we traveled around. So it was fun buying clothes in Liberia because you would just see stuff from Ohio turn up there. You'd see stuff from, you know, St. Louis. And often we would see not the winning team, but the losing team. And we'd be like, wait a minute, they didn't win that Super Bowl.
Right.
And then you'd look and see that, oh, they were the loser of that Super Bowl.
A lot of Lions gear. Yeah, that's funny. Wait a minute, where did this come from? I didn't realize that happened, but it does make sense that they print up all the T-shirts, make all the hats, and they're just in boxes, probably at various outlets or shipping outlets or something like that, waiting to be, you know, in maybe even loaded in a truck, ready to go, and the game ends. And it's like, rip open the right box, and the rest of it just goes back to wherever.
Right, but it's not like anybody in Detroit wants to wear, you know, a shirt that has a team that actually didn't win.
Yeah.
declared the victors.
Although that is kind of cool swag. Like, wait a minute, especially if you're wearing it the day after. The Super Bowl champs, it's like, wait a minute, I saw that game, they didn't win. Like, you don't look like anyone else. Everyone's got the winning team on, and you're like, I'm going a little contrarian here. Water didn't mean much to you in the beginning. Wells didn't mean much to you in the beginning. How did you begin to realize the significance of clean water? Where did this come about?
My first part of the time in Africa was mainly spent in the operating theater, was spent documenting these surgeries, was spent in the city. But I signed up for a second tour. So I did this first year, and then I went back to Liberia, this time for an the full eight-month stint. And I got off the ship and I spent more and more time in the rural areas, more and more time out in the bush, really, in these remote villages. And it's there that I came face to face with a problem, with something that hadn't even occurred to me before. And I saw people drink dirty water. I saw kids drinking from green algae-filled swamps, from ponds, from disgusting brown viscous rivers. And I learned that 50% of the people living in the country at that time, 50% didn't have clean water to drink. So it was like an aha moment. Wow, we have thousands of people turning up sick, right? Standing in fields, standing in parking lots outside stadiums, but yet half the people in the country, their most basic need isn't even met. And, you know, I started telling the doctors and surgeons in the operating theater what I was seeing out there. I started showing them some of the photos, and they began just to encourage me. Well, first of all, they were like, duh, you know, yeah, we know, you know, half the disease throughout the developing world is actually caused by bad water and lack of sanitation, lack of hygiene. We know that water makes people sick, or bad water makes people sick. And then they said, well, why don't you go work on that? I had a mentor on the ship, a guy named Dr. Gary Parker, and he had this amazing story, Jordan. He'd signed up for 3 months of service, and when I got on the ship, he'd been there 21 years. He just never left. And this guy, you know, for me, became a picture of, A, living out faith with the most humility, you know, living it out through passionate service, right? This guy came from California, could have been a surgeon, a plastic surgeon, you know, to millionaires, living in a giant house and driving expensive cars. And instead he lived in a tiny cabin on a ship for 21 years.
My God.
Using the thing that he was best at to serve people who could never pay him. So Dr. Gary really encouraged me to consider focusing on water. You really want to help people get well, Scott. You really want to end sickness and suffering in the world. Why don't you just make sure people have clean water to drink?
How many people does dirty water kill versus other things that we actually worry about, like terrorism and things like that?
Well, it kills more people than all violence in the world every year, including all the wars and all the conflicts. At the time, it was 4,500 kids dying every single day. So that's a stadium, you know, that's a basketball stadium every 3.5 days.
Oh, wow.
Dead, not sick, right? You know, just for comparison, people have been talking about Flint, Michigan, you know, recently.
In
Flint, somewhere between 6,000 and 12,000 children were exposed to lead, right? That's that amount of kids are actually dying every 3 days. You know, it was an astronomical statistic for me to just think of I'd never thought of water before, Jordan. I mean, I used to sell Voss water for $10 in the nightclub, those big, tall glass bottles. And people would buy 10 bottles sometimes, just let it sit there. They wouldn't even break the seal. They wouldn't even open it. They're drinking champagne or vodka instead. So it just never occurred to me that a tenth of the world was living without clean water. I'd always had clean water. I took long showers. You know, I would mow lawns, you know, that were well watered growing up. And I knew pools and just golf courses, right? Water was everywhere, except it wasn't for 1 out of 10 people. And it wasn't for 50% of the people living in Liberia. So I became really interested in water. And that became the one thing of all the other things that I'd seen that I said, I am going to focus on this, not on my watch. All right, this is just not okay that a guy like me could sell $10 water in a nightclub, you know, could ring $50,000 in booze and could sell $10,000 of champagne to someone who comes in. And yet a tenth of the world doesn't have this most basic need. So that's how I became interested in water.
So Dr. Gary tells you how to help. Actions, not words. What action steps did you then take? How did this become not just, well, someone should do something about that, but I'm going to do something about that?
Well, I was 30 when I came home to New York City, and my life looked nothing like it did before. So my friends, I think a lot of people, Jordan, were watching. They were getting these emails, you know, because I'm blasting my 15,000 person club list with dirty water pictures, with tumor pictures, with pictures of leprosy. I certainly a couple of people are like, unsubscribe, dude, take me off of this thing.
Yeah.
Most people though were actually deeply moved by these stories and would write me back saying, I didn't know this kind of suffering existed. I need to do something about this. How do I give money? How do I volunteer like you and make a difference in the lives of others? So the thing that I learned most over that 2 year period with Mercy Ships was that I still had a gift for promoting. I'd been promoting this idea for 10 years that if you got past the velvet rope, if you got past the throng of people lined up outside the nightclub, if you got in and into the VIP, and if you spent all your money drinking, you know, and you went home with the right beautiful people, then your life had meaning. You had arrived. And I deeply believe that was the wrong message. That was a destructive, unhelpful message. And what I got to do with the 2 years in Mercy Ships is I got to still promote, but promote something that was just so opposite. I got to promote the stories of these humanitarian doctors, stories of selflessness, stories of radical empathy and compassion. I got to invite people to be a part of something truly redemptive, something that really helped others. So I tried to apply all of those things that I'd learned to water, which was going to be my thing now, right? I wasn't going to go and build hospital ships or recruit doctors. I wanted to end the water crisis. I wanted to help usher in a day on Earth where every single person alive had clean water to drink, regardless of where they were born. You know, I was born into middle-class privilege. It never occurred to me that I would have to drink dirty water in my life. And now at 43 years old, I still never have. You know, I've been to 69 countries. I've been to Ethiopia 30 times. I can afford to buy bottled water and put it in the back of my Land Rover. I can afford to row into a village with a water filter that can clean a dirty river so I don't die of some terrible disease. I wanted to make sure everybody alive had this basic gift. So I'm 30. My friends have now seen that I am different. One more thing I should say, you know, before I walked up the gangway of the ship, I quit everything. I quit smoking and never smoked again. I quit gambling. I never gambled again. I never looked at a pornographic image again. I never touched Coke or X or any of that stuff again. I believed I had to walk so far in the other direction. I had to completely change my life, not 45 degrees, not 90 degrees, 180 degrees. And there was something symbolic or prophetic about walking up the gangway of a ship and sailing away into a new life and leaving all of that crap, all of that, the past vices on shore. So it was a radical moment for me. I remember going out with a bang, and it's been funny after writing the book, like all these stories have surfaced now of people's impression of me that first day. And the night before, I smoked the final three packs of cigarettes, and I drank like seven or eight beers, and I turned up to report for active duty on the ship with a terrible hangover and apparently smelling like alcohol, like smelling like I'd hit a bar that morning.
Oh, they must have been like, this guy is not going to make it.
Euro chic guy who just turned up from a bar. I think I was wearing Prada, bro. I mean, it was.
They're like, you're not going to need that in Liberia. And no. In the engine room or whatever, like you're sleeping there. And you had that last hurrah. I know you actually kind of got on the ship on a little bit of a downswing. You did sort of have a detour at a casino before getting on the boat. You want to tell us about that?
I did. I had a few last hurrahs. I gambled one last time. And of course, that went terribly and I lost all my money. And it was actually a great reminder that there is no joy in this stuff, right? Even if I had won, I just needed to leave it all behind. So I had my one last taste of everything. I mean, I wasn't obviously doing, you know, cocaine the night before the ship.
Yeah.
I kind of had that one last hurrah. I remember walking up the gangway of the ship, determined to stop smoking, that I would never smoke again. And I had a Nicorette patch on my arm and I was chewing the gum. just trying to make sure that I could actually survive. And, you know, by the grace of God, somehow I was able to just never do the stuff again and not miss it that much.
How did your nightlife experience and unconventional skills help you with Charity Water? Because after Mercy Ships and you starting Charity Water, you have to market a charity. You have to run a charity. Did this parallel your nightclub promotion life in any way? Because business is business in a lot of ways, even if it's charity or nightlife.
And I think storytelling is storytelling. And what good nightclub promoters have to do is they have to tell a story. They have to keep things interesting. They have to keep things new. So we would try and theme our parties. We would try and get the best DJs and always create a sense of excitement, this sense of exclusivity, the sense of scarcity. And effectively, we were inviting people to a party. Right? We were inviting people to a celebration. And when I started Charity Water, as I had the advantage, so on paper, right, I'm uniquely unqualified to start a charity. I'm uniquely unqualified to go and raise money. My only experience was 10 years of getting people drunk at 40 clubs and then running around as a photojournalist following a bunch of doctors and learning about an issue, the water crisis. So I tried to use that to my advantage by saying, well, I guess I get to start with a clean slate of paper. I don't have any of the trappings of institutional philanthropy or big charity. And as I started talking to everyday people, Jordan, I realized that my friends were not giving to charities. They were not giving to the Red Crosses of the world, the Salvation Armies. They didn't trust charities. Yeah, they thought charities were black holes that sucked up their money. They thought charities were bureaucratic and inefficient. And, you know, everybody seemed to have a scandal or a horror story they could pull out of their back pocket and talk about a charity that had done the wrong thing. And I realized there was data behind this. You know, 42% of Americans identified as distrusting charity.
Sure.
And 70% of Americans that were polled by NYU's Stern School, 70% of Americans said they believed charities either wasted money or badly wasted money.
That's
right.
A huge,
so 30% of the people, 30, and like, come on, who is more generous than Americans, right? There's no, I don't think there's a country on earth with a reputation of being better neighbors, you know, at least as we give to the poor. I mean, there's a culture of giving. So I saw that as a huge entrepreneurial opportunity, a huge opportunity to disrupt maybe traditional philanthropy with the new business model and just listen to people. So as I started talking to people, I'm like, well, what kind of charity would you want to give to? And they're like, well, I'd want to know exactly where my money goes. Okay. And I said, well, I'd want to know the people that it helped. I'd want proof. I'd want to see it. So just started putting this business model together that wound up really with four pillars. And the first was we made this public promise that 100% of all donations we would ever take in, every single penny ever given to Charity Water, would directly fund water projects that would give people clean water. We opened up a separate bank account for the overhead. And I said, I'm going to raise that overhead separately from a very small group of people and entrepreneurs and families who will pay for our office costs and our flights and our staff salaries and our 401k if we ever even got there. But 100% of the public's money will only and always go to water projects. The second pillar was, let's just tell people what we did with that money. Let's prove every project. So we had good timing. We started the same year as Google Earth and Google Maps. And I said, let's just put up every water project on Google where people can see the actual satellite images of these projects. They could see the pictures, the photos, the GPS coordinates, sometimes even video of clean water flowing. And then we said, okay, well, let's also try and build an epic brand. You know, so many charities, I think they use shame and guilt to peddle their wares, to guilt people into giving. And you guys remember some of those commercials, the leftovers from the 80s and the sad looking kids with flies landing on their
Sally
face.
Struthers and stuff.
Sally Struthers, yeah. You got it.
Yeah.
And the 800 number would slowly crawl across the screen and, you know, you'd say, oh, that's just awful. And some people would give, but you don't tell your friends about that charity. Right? You don't wear that charity's t-shirt. You know, to me, it would be as if Nike told people that they were fat and lazy to turn off the stupid TV and go run, go exercise. Right. And people wouldn't, they wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And they certainly wouldn't want to go buy the clothes from a company that spoke to them like that. And in fact, Nike's success has come from telling inspirational stories over decades, stories of people overcoming adversity. So stories of people who beat impossible odds. And Nike says, there's greatness within you. We believe you have the power to achieve far more than you ever thought. Yeah. And someone like turns off the TV and says, maybe I could go for a jog. And you want to tell your friends about the company. You want to wear the logo of a brand that believes that about you. And charities just didn't behave that way. So I thought, let's build the Nike or the Apple or the Virgin of charities. Let's build an imaginative, inspirational charity that focuses on hope and opportunity. Let's invite people into the story. You hear this term all the time now, giving back. I'm so sick of this language. You know, charities, you know, my company has a program where we're giving back. Mm-hmm. And that language implies debt. It implies obligation. It's like we've pillaged and plundered to such extent that we should finally throw some scraps down to the poor. You know, here's the leftovers. Let's give a little back. You know, it's like if I walk up to you and I grab the phone out of your hand, you're going to say, give it back.
Right. Right?
Why don't we drop back? Why don't we talk about a pure culture of giving? Just, hey, we build a culture of giving in our family. We build a culture of giving in our company, giving the best of ourselves, giving because it's a blessing and a joy, giving, you know, out of the abundance that we've giving out of the privilege that we've been blessed with, giving our time, our talent, our money in the service of others. So I just had all these ideas about branding Charity Water in a countercultural way. And then the fourth pillar was just, let's not send any Westerners, anybody with my skin color, over to Africa or India or Southeast Asia to go and drill wells. I believe that for the work to be sustainable, it had to be led by the locals in each of these countries. For the work to be culturally relevant, the locals must lead their communities and their countries forward. So our role would be to get everyday, often apathetic people to care about an issue that almost feels paralyzingly big, move them to action through this new business model where they can trust again, and then make sure that the locals were the ones taking that money and turning it into clean water, and that they would be the ones getting the credit, and they would be the local heroes. So that was the business model. And you know, today when I say these things, it sounds so not innovative in a way. I mean, it just sounds so common sense, right? It's not like we're landing rockets on platforms, you know, in the middle of oceans, but it was so unique at the time, and the organization just took off.
The 100% model of having a separate overhead account that pays for everything and then having the rest of the money go directly to charity or to the cause must have been a game changer, because I think that really does solve the trust problem that most of us have. I know we were speaking before about certain people, celebrities especially, not wanting to get behind something, because then you find out later, the person who runs this gets paid $700,000 a year and is flying in their own jet. And you're like, what? Yep. This is what I raised all this money for. So you don't have that problem. You have kind of the closed model where some folks are donating because they understand how charities work, so they're paying for the overhead. And then the radical transparency of everything else that allows people to realize their donation is going to something that they want, to what they actually want it to go to.
That's right. And today, if you fast forward that model to present state, 131 families and entrepreneurs pay for all of our overhead. And it's significant. We have 80 full-time employees in New York City. And it's been the founders of Facebook, of Twitter, of Spotify, of WordPress, of Pandora. It's been executives at Apple. It's venture capitalists. It's, you know, it's people like Gary Vaynerchuk over the years. Like friends that have said, we want our money to go to the overhead. We want to actually help you go hire employee number 81 and 82. We want to pay for the receptionists and the accountants and the software engineers so that you can make this 100% promise. And that's now allowed over a million people to give in the purest way possible. People don't even know this, Jordan, but we pay back credit card fees. So if you went on our website right now and let's say you joined our monthly program at $100 a month, I wish we got $100 a month. But if you use your Amex, we get $97 a month. But we actually make up the difference. So we pay that $3 back that we didn't even get from your donation. And we send $100, the $100 you intended to give to the field. So it's a true 100%. And I think this took what we later learned was the most common objection people have about giving to charity. How much of my money is actually going to get there? And it just it nullified it. I mean, it was a bit of a drop the mic. What's your next excuse? Water, sorry, you can't get behind the idea that human beings need clean water to flourish. So I think we have these two powerful things going. Water being an issue that everybody could agree on, whether you're a Jew or a Muslim or a Christian or an atheist or a Mormon, everybody could agree on clean water for humans, regardless of your political views. Or I mean, everybody could just agree to agree on this idea. And then we had this 100% model. And then further, this idea that we would prove what we did with that money. And it was just all very powerful.
You're really great at building relationships, and you always have been, or at least you always have been with Charity Water. Are there certain systems or principles or techniques that you use to maintain large networks of people at the same time? I mean, you had that email list, of course, but what do you use now that you've probably got 10,000 plus people in your orbit?
10,000 plus, a couple millions now.
Sure, yeah. But I mean, you personally.
I think social media was really important to the success of Charity Water. And a lot of that was just good timing. I remember inviting myself to speak at Twitter headquarters when there were 28 employees at Twitter. I remember speaking at Facebook on University Avenue where the place was covered in graffiti. And we just realized that this was how the movements of the future would be built. Not through direct mail, right? Buying Jordan and his wife's physical mailing address and sending you a bunch of paper and saying, hey, Jordan, could you guys please put a check in that self-addressed stamped envelope and mail it back to me? But that was not the future. That's going to round down to zero. And we just thought the Twitters, the Facebooks, the Instagrams, the Snapchats of the world, this is how people would connect in real time and in quicker feedback loops. And we just embraced that. So we were the first charity to get a million Twitter followers and the first charity to use Instagram. And just we time and time again tried to grow and develop and celebrate our community on all those different platforms. And we still do that today.
There's a lot of examples in Thirst about some of the brilliant marketing. It's not even just marketing. The experience that you've curated for some of the people at charity galas and things like that, like digging the well in real time and satellite feed of a video of you guys doing this. And to what do you attribute some of that? Is that from your club promotion days or is that just you being a talented storyteller initially?
I think I love telling stories, Jordan. I just love telling stories. And that's one of the things that I would say if we could only pick one thing the Charity Water was good at, and we had to ditch all the rest, I would take storytelling over the 100% model. I really think it's that powerful. I think people respond to stories. If I tell, you know, people who are listening right now, hey, there's 663 million people without water and 4,500 kids dying a day and women are walking 40 billion hours every year and 52% of the disease in the world is caused by bad water, people just kind of numb out to that. But if I tell you a story of a 13-year-old girl from a village called Meda in Ethiopia who was walking 8 hours every day for water, and one day at the end of a long journey, she drops to the ground after tripping and she spills her water and she breaks her clay pot. and she ties a rope around her neck and hangs herself from the tree nearby. That's a different way of demonstrating the water crisis. And that story is actually sadly true. There was a little girl named Letikiris Hailu that I write about in the book who took her own life after spilling her water. Just didn't want to go back. Didn't want to embrace 8 hours a day of walking for water anymore. And over the years, we've told stories both of tragedy and also of great hope and great joy. One of my favorites is a woman named Helen Apio in Uganda. And she got clean water from a charity water project for the first time in her life. And we asked her how her life was different. And she said, you know, for the first time in my life, she said, I am beautiful. Not I feel beautiful. She said, I am beautiful. And we're like, what do you mean? And she said, well, you don't understand. I just never had enough water before. And I would always use the little water that I would walk for. And I would use it for my husband and my children. And she said, I always put my family first. But now, with enough clean water near my house, I could take all the water I want. And I finally have enough water to wash my face and my body and my clothes. And I am beautiful. A story like that makes you think about water differently than a statistic. And I think that's just something that comes natural to us. So in the same way that, you know, I was trying to always tell the new story for whatever club we were working at, it's how do we get people to connect to this issue? How do we get them to care? How do we get them to reject apathy? Right? It's so easy when you come across any of these global problems that affect other people thousands of miles away across oceans, right? People you've never met, problems you've never encountered. It's just so easy to embrace apathy and say, like, what could I ever do? The freaking global water crisis? Like, you know, I work a job at Walmart, or, you know, I don't know, I'm a telemarketer, or I'm an entrepreneur. Like, what could I ever do to actually make a difference? And what we have tried to do through storytelling and through our business model is say, everything makes a difference. A dollar makes a difference. $30 makes a difference. An entire water project makes a difference. Your donated birthday makes a difference. And now 1 million people have said, you know what? I can do something about it. I can add my voice. And that's now allowed us to bring clean water to 8.5 million people in 29,000 villages. So we're now 1/78th of the way there. Charity Water has now helped 1/78th of all the people on earth that need it. So we feel like we're at the beginning of the journey. There's so much work left to do. We need to go faster. We need to help more people. We need to grow the movement from 1 million people to 2 million to 5 million to 10 million until we can finally create this day on earth where no one's drinking bad water.
So your goal is to bring water, clean water, to 100 million people, and you're 1/78th of the way there.
No, 663 million people. So that's the current state. One out of every 10 people alive today is drinking bad water. So we're at 8.5 of 663.
Oh, wow.
3% of the problem.
It's daunting, man. That's a lot of people that don't have clean water.
It is. Or you could just say, hey, just go 78 times faster. Just do 78 times more.
Yeah.
How can 8.4 times 78, which is a number less than 100 at least, equals 663, and you're there.
How hard can it be? How can people get involved as well if they're interested in doing that?
I think two ways. You know, grab the book. 100% of all my author net proceeds, the advance, all that goes to Charity Water. So
you're not making a ton of money off the book.
I'm not making a penny off the book. So everything from Thirst goes to Charity Water, and I'm just so excited to share the stories that were in it. You and your wife read it. I tried to be vulnerable. I tried to tell stories that I hope would help people on a personal level, maybe actually get unstuck or maybe find their purpose. I think there's stories in there for entrepreneurs. There's stories of boneheaded failure, of just all the times we did stupid stuff and screwed up, and what we learned from that. People just go to thirstbook.com, and we've also built an unbelievable interactive website experience, which I think people will love. And then the second is really to join the spring. And, you know, if I could just take a second to talk about how important this is for us.
Sure.
A lot of people that have been following Charity Water over the years know that we ask people to give up their birthdays, and that was just a big thing for us. And there was this movement of people donating their birthdays, turning them into these little fundraising moments, little mini word of mouth movements, and raising $500 for their birthday, or $620, or $42, or whatever. And that was great. And that took us to a great place in the first 10 years. But what we realized was we weren't building continuity. We weren't building a community of people that were continuing to show up. They would only do one birthday. And so many people would learn about charity, whatever, they'd learn about this. They go on our website and they drop $100 once or $1,000 once. And we said, for us to really make the lasting impact we want to make, we're going to need to adopt the practices of a Netflix or a Spotify, right? Or an HBO or a Dropbox. I mean, people are showing up for Netflix every single month, right? Over 130 million people, I think it is now, are showing up every single month with their $15. Now, of course, they're getting content. They're getting benefit from that. Same thing with Spotify, right? People are turning up, paying their $10 a month, listening to music. We said, well, what if we could build a community of people? What if we could get 1 million people, let's say, to show up, you know, let's say $30 a month. That's what it costs us to give one person clean water. And not just drive by and hit $30 once or you know, do one birthday, but actually stick with us month in, month out, faithfully fighting for change. What if we could build this loyal, dedicated, passionate community of generous people? And then we make the promise that we'd always use 100% of their money, whether it was $10 a month or $30 a month or $100 a month. And we would then show them stories of impact from around the world. So we launched the spring and said, this is the best way that people can join Charity Water. And this may take us years, right? So we're not going to say this is going to be done next year or 3 years or 5 years, but we would hope to build this community of people that could one day tell their kids and their grandkids, I was actually a part of ending the water crisis. I was a part of this day, creating and ushering in this day when every human has access to life's most basic needs. So my wife is a member. I'm a member. It's just a really simple way to get involved. And people could just go to charitywater.org/spring to learn more and to join us.
Scott, thank you so much. The book Thirst is really, there's a lot of, I hate to say like, you'll laugh, you'll cry, right? But it really has a lot of great stories in it. And it's funny watching you now, knowing you now, being friends with you now and seeing what you're doing and then hearing about like how you kind of bumbled through a lot of stuff earlier in the game. And just some of the mistakes you made were very educational. And I do think that your path is very unique. Not a lot of people go from being the guy in the Manhattan club scene to running a super innovative charity. It's not the normal route that one's life might take.
Yeah. Well, it's been a joy to be able to hopefully, you know, redeem a lot of the boneheaded mistakes and some of those things that I learned club promoting and some of those relationships and turn it for good. And, you know, we'll keep fighting until everybody has clean water to drink.
What do you think, Jason? I told you, great storyteller and kind of a crazy past that guy has.
Yeah, he has one hell of a career path, I got to say. And as far as somebody who used to party in my 20s, he puts me to shame. So that was a great story. And it's a redemption story, I think, for a lot of people who might have been, you know, in some kind of crazy lifestyle and want to change and do something good for the world. I think he's kind of a beacon of hope for people that really want to change.
Yeah, he's got the book Thirst has crazy story. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg. He's got so many things in there that he's done, the way he creatively markets Charity Water. He's just got amazing ideas. Storytelling for the win. He is, if he's got a talent, that's it. He just really, really nails it. And the book is a quick, easy read. Very, very interesting. Didn't think I was going to love it as much as I did. My wife, Jen, she loved it. And I was going to read it, of course, but I really thought, wow, this is something definitely special as far as stories are concerned. You know, because you read books that are about charity sometimes and you go, all right, this is like the hyped up version of an idea you had at a dinner table. He had a much longer path to redemption, you might say.
Absolutely.
Great big thank you to Scott Harrison. The book title is Thirst. And if you want to know how I managed to make all these interesting friends, manage all my relationships using systems and tiny habits in just a few minutes per day, not dedicating my whole life to it, check out our Level 1 course. It's free. It's over at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. And I know a lot of people say, look, I'm busy. I'll do it later. And I got so much going on right now. I can't do this right now. This is minutes per day. That's the whole point. The problem with kicking the can down the road, we're not able to make up for lost time when it comes to relationships, networking. This is the top mistake I see is people don't dig the well before they're thirsty. If you want to leverage a relationship and you don't have it, you're already too late. So start now. And these drills are just a few moments per day. Instagram time, Starbucks line time. This is the stuff I wish I knew a decade ago. It is not fluff. It is crucial. And you can find all of it at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. Speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway here from Scott Harrison. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. Doing a lot on Instagram these days. I'm going to start doing some Q&A, I think, soon as well. We're going to step up our video game for the shows. There's all kinds of stuff going on the Instagram, at Jordan Harbinger, so find me there. And don't forget, if you want to learn how to apply everything you just heard from Scott Harrison, make sure you go grab the worksheets, also in the show notes, at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. This episode was produced and edited by Jason Thirsty for More DeFilippo. Show notes are by Robert Fogarty. Worksheets by Caleb Bacon. Booking, back office, and last-minute miracles by Jen Harbinger, who also helped me with prep on this one. And I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. The fee for this show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which is hopefully in every episode. So please, share the show with those you love, share the show with those you don't. Lots more in the pipeline. Very excited to hear what you think about it. And in the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time.